tinfoil hat.
Oh, what the fuck are you guys even talking about?
Global controls will have to be imposed, and a world governing body will be created to enforce them.
Welcome to Tinfoil Hat. We go deep, homeboy. Eric, open your mind. Drink from the fountain of knowledge. There's lizard people everywhere. That's some interdimensional shit. Wake up, Aaron.
This is only the beginning.
Dude, you just blew my mind.
Are you ready to get your mind blown?
Revolution will be podcasted.
Yeah. Boom, we're back, man. Back in the saddle. It's another wonderful episode of Tinfoil Hat. You know who I am. You know what I'm here to do. I'm here to rock, okay? And joining me, as always, is my good friend XG and the place to be.
What's up?
What's up, buddy?
Ooh, I'm excited. This month's coming. We're coming hard.
Yeah, this episode is going to blow some minds. We got some wonderful stuff coming on. Tinfoil Hat is for the people, okay? And we're bringing the show to the people. First show up is next Tuesday at the World Famous Comedy Store. We have a wonderful show called Comedy Chaos. The lineups are stacked with superstars. There's an 8 and a 10:30 show, and that show is brought to you by our good friends at Absolute Extract. If you go to abx.org, you, my friends, can get set up with some sweet weed. We're talking flower, vape pens, gels, ointments. You got a bad back, huh? Boom, throw a little CBD on that, makes you feel better, okay? Now, I can't guarantee you this, but if you put CBD on your forehead, you become smarter, okay? By 10 IQ points. Can't guarantee it, but try it anyways. Good things. And guys, hook your ladies up. They got CBD for the vajayjay. Hook that up. Like I'm telling you, we're working on like a CBD boner combo. I'm going to get Absolute Extract and our good friends at Blue Chew come together, get you high and hard at the same time.
Ooh, that's what you want.
Yeah,
high and hard at the same time. What more do you want?
Yeah, that's for the ladies and the gentlemen.
And shout out to Tiger. He's always hooking me up. Every time I go there, he's got beer.
Set ups, yep. Dude. If you come to Comedy Chaos, you say, yo, lizard people everywhere, I'm going to hook you up with a vape pen. That's what I'm going to do. But you got to prove to me you went to abx.org. So go check them out. They're bringing in Comedy Chaos. Then at the end of next week,
the 14th.
June 14th, we are live. We are live at Hyenas in Plano, Texas. That's right. It's the Alien Shot JFK Tour. XG, Eddie Bravo, myself, Reed Becker, live at Plano, Texas. We're at the Hyenas. Tickets are available to that. And then the following night, we're back in our old stomping grounds. That's right. It's the Secret Group in Houston. We're going to be there. Come rock out. Watch Eddie Bravo go hard in the paint. And then what are we doing?
Then we got Skank Fest.
No, then we're going to a strip bar with hot black women.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
okay?
Yeah, of course.
That's the plan. We're going hard in the paint with the fucking red bone and light skinned ladies and either some deep space.
I always come back with less money. Yeah. I know I'm going to come back with less money. It's going to be like, fuck, yeah, Sam, I should have just stayed home.
Somewhere out there, there's going to be a chick having my baby. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to go there. And then we're very excited that the following week after that, that's June
20 through the 23rd.
June 20 to the 23rd. We are in New York. We're in Brooklyn at Skankfest live. Tinfoil Hat, myself, XG, and our good friend Tim Dillon from Tim Dillon's Going to Hell. He will be joining us live. I'll be doing some live stand-up. XG will be doing some stand-up, but we will be in Brooklyn. So come out wherever you are. And then we're proud to announce July 6th. We are in Huntington Beach at the Rec Room. It's Tinfoil Hat Comedy Night. Again, Eddie Bravo, XG, myself, plus some friends will be rocking out there. I'm pretty sure this show will sell out. So grab your tickets now, Huntington Beach, Orange County. Get them now because we're going hard in the paint, dog.
Ooh.
Go to recroomhb.com. Grab those tickets. T-shirts are available, man. You want to support the show? We got some great T-shirts coming out. We got... What T-shirts do we have?
We got the tinfoil one.
We got loyal to the foil.
Oh, and we got that new one coming up. We got a surprise from.
Yeah, we got a new one. I'm super excited. I'm not going to show you, but a brand new coming out. We got that. Go to go to tinfoilhattshirts.com. Join us. Buy a shirt. Represent, okay? The Patreon's going good. People are calling conspiracies now the greatest, worst public access show in the history of time. See us talk about public, whatever. We talk conspiracies live on Patreon, and I do a weekly Q&A live on the channel as well. So go join us that. And if you love me and you love comedy, check out my specials on YouTube. Go to youtube.com/SamTripoli or put Sam Tripoli Stand Up, Sam Tripoli Specials. I got two on there, Armageddon and Zero Fucks. Those are available for free. Check them out because I'm coming to a city near you and you got to see how hard I rock. And I rock hard.
I love the nutsack you gave me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I love that, dude.
I've been using that shit.
Our good friends at Nutsack. Look at this bag. Nutsack Ooh. Bags. They are joining us, dude. I'm tired of women carrying around purses, and we got to get the best we can get are what? Fanny packs? Huh? I'm a grown man. I go to work. I pay my bills. I don't want a fanny pack. I want something that is durable, and that's our good friends at Nutsack, no K, just Nutsac. That's right. Perfect bags for everyday carries. I do it all the time. My computer, my boner pills, you name it, I keep them in this bag. They're high-quality materials and craft shit. American wax, cannabis, American leather, and American labor. A bag for American men made in America. That's how we do it. It is strong, water-resistant. Give us 2 weeks and we'll change your life. Guaranteed you'll love our nutsack. That's right. Nutsacks, bro. Our products come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Comfortable bags that are the right size for you. Rugged, durable bag that you can beat the hell out of it. There we go. Items that, yep. No more stuffed pockets. No more sitting on your wallet. I hate that. I hate that. Okay? Or having your keys poke your thighs. Always be prepared. That's right. Better organization. Just grab a nutsack and go. So what's going to happen, dude? You guys go. Right now, Nutsack is offering our listeners $5 off their first purchase. That's money you could use on other stuff like weed. Okay? Like our high and hard boner CBD pills I'm making, okay? To receive your $5 discount, visit Nutsack, no K, NUTSAC.com. That's Nutsack.com, okay? Use the promo code, all capital letters, tinfoil hat, one word, at checkout. So I'm excited. They're our good friends. Support this. I use it all the time. I didn't think I'd use it, and I really do. Yes, I feel like I work for the Pony Express, but you know what? I get there, dude.
You know what? You know you can get a black nutsack?
Really?
Yeah.
I've always wanted a black nutsack.
Yep. Black or tan.
Wow. Well, that's the business today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you love the show, you listen to the business because they support the show and you find out where we're going to come near your house. Now, near where you live. Now, if not enough people show up, guess what? The show can't come back. So it's on you to support the show because we love you so much. Guys, we got a great show coming for you today. This is our returning champion, one of the most popular shows we've done. He is author of the book, Drugs as a Weapon Against Us. He came in and told us how basically the opium industry built the U.S. power structure, and he's now here to talk about us. Please welcome John Potash, everybody. How are you, John?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Sam and XG.
We loved having you on. Your last appearance changed the way I see everything, how I see the power structure, the CIA, the war on drugs, and I'm super excited to have you on today. You kind of brought this up last time, and I wanted to follow up, but it's basically Courtney Love, the history of Courtney Love, her involvement in possible CIA, MK Ultra, program and stuff like that. And so here we are, man. John, so where do you want to start? Where would you like to start on this incredibly interesting story?
Thanks. So just to tell viewers that there's a new film out called, you know, Drugs and Weapons Against Us, and the subtitle is The CIA War on Musicians and Activists. And of course, the film is based on my book, and I came out with the film few years after the book. Yeah.
Did you produce the film? Were you part of that?
I did. I produced the film.
Well, I love that, man. Go. Where is that? Where can they find that?
So it's streaming now on Amazon Prime. You can, you know, get it, rent, you see it there, rent it there. And it's on like about 5 or 6 other platforms. It's on Vudu. It's on Vimeo. It's on Yahoo, whatever. It's on Google Play. It's on iTunes.
It's out there, man. Support John. He's doing great work. He's getting out the information that they don't want you to know. And when you start hearing what he talks about, you start realizing who the real bad guys are. It's not crackheads on the corner. It's not heroin addicts, okay? If you'd say to me, why should my taxpayer money go to help drug addicts? Well, your taxpayer money is helping to go to drug addicts because you're paying for the military servicemen who protect the poppy fields. Okay, right. So you're already involved in this. So instead of sitting back here and crying like a baby, why don't you learn about who's really the bad guys and who's not the bad guys? And it's not the heroin addict on the corner that got hooked because his neighbor got flooded. It's the lizard people in boardrooms who fucking send our boys and girls in to curb stomp fucking Middle Easterns and steal the poppy fields.
Right. So just going, I'm going to do an overview. I'm going to try to do a quick overview of the history that led up to Courtney Love. And so the history is, as you mentioned, so the opium shipping families, with the British, it was the British East India Company. But in America, it was families named the Russells, the Cabots of Harvard that started Harvard University. The Russells started Yale University. The Lowes that started Columbia University. The Greens that started Princeton University. The Delanos of FDR fame, Franklin Delano Roosevelt fame. These were all the wealthiest families because they made their wealth off of opium shipping. So they start these universities, they start these exclusive clubs in these universities like Skull and Blunt Bones, and in Harvard it was the Porcelain Club, and they give each graduate $250,000 or today's worth $250,000 upon graduation. So these guys start with a huge amount of money to go into the great, you know, the big businesses, and they came from wealth already. And so the Rockefellers came out of these places. The Pierponts intermarried with the Russells, and so John Pierpont Morgan was intermarried with the Russell family. And of course, the Rockefellers, Pierponts, and J.P. Morgan became some of the most powerful families in the country. You know, along with the Carnegies and Vanderbilts and all that, also graduated from these schools and these clubs. And the Dulles brothers actually were the lawyers for the Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan interests, who actually bought out most of the top newspapers and magazines in the 19-teens to gain the most influence in our country. So that's why independent media like yours are so important. So So these families and the Dulles brothers then started the CIA. And then in 1953, they combined a bunch of projects they were working on to become MKUltra, Project MKUltra. And they had a lot of Nazi scientists that were already working and experimenting with psychedelics and other drugs in the concentration camps. So they were the top researchers on drugs.
Now, the Nazis called it Liebensporn, and the H-A-N-E-N-E-R-B-E. It was like this occult stuff that the Nazis were looking for, like pure white children. And they would either like kidnap them or just basically invade Poland and all these other countries and pull these kids out and put them into these programs. And then later on, give them up to adoption to SS families. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I've heard about their bizarre Aryan, finding the perfect Aryan race kind of stuff. But they were also doing twin studies and just experimenting on Jewish twins, you know, just dissecting them, taking them apart, doing all kinds of crazy crap to them to see if they can, with twins, they can find, you know, produce the master race. But they were doing a lot of crazy experiments. But I just focused on their use of drugs in particular to control people. And when they brought all their drug experimentation into MKUltra, MKUltra then proceeded to test several dozen different drugs on thousands of soldiers. In my state, it was Edgewood Arsenal soldiers, 1,000 or 2 Edgewood Arsenal soldiers, but in different places around the country they did this. And they now the top drugs, according to their own documents, the top drugs they used were actually LSD was the biggest drug they used. But then, of course, heroin and other opiates, cocaine, you know, benzos and other drugs like that, they also used. MDMA, actually, ecstasy they used too in its early state, which was MDA. So they then – so we get a lot of this information from the U.S. Senate Church Committee's report plus MKUltra documents themselves. And Senate Church Committee found that they used LSD. They dosed tons of Americans and British and other people around the world, and they used these drugs as what they called for unconventional warfare. And so this warfare was against anyone who dissented from their incredibly pro-war racist opinions. Okay, that was their agenda. It was extremely racist and extremely pro-war. I mean, just like the Nazi agenda, because the Nazis were working on it. But the CIA, it was started by these folks that were incredibly racist and incredibly like pro-war.
Yeah, the Nazis. They basically, the Nazis entered an expansion draft and were brought over to the United States. Like World War II was about bringing the pharmaceutical companies from Germany to the United States. And then World War I. World War II was just basically about getting the Nazis out of Germany. And they went to either Russia, England, I think, in the United States, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Well, the Ford company, Rockefellers, were had their companies interlocked with IG Farben, which was the biggest chemical company in the world out of Germany. Okay, and IG Farben was Bayer aspirin, but they were the first manufacturers of commercial heroin, and a number of other different companies. Sandoz, who was the first manufacturer of LSD, and so they were interlocked, and they wanted to get this expertise over to the United States, and they did that with Operation Paperclip, which brought tons of these Nazi scientists over. And Operation Sunshine brought tons of Nazis, at least 10,000, down to Latin America to control the cocaine-producing regions down there. So here you go. They used an MKUltra. And so when you get to the mid-60s, 1965, you got assistant director of MKUltra was a guy named Robert Lashbrook. In 65, Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor, A.E. Hotchner, says that Lashbrook brings tons of acid, tons of agents, and tons of money over to London and tells his agents to get this acid in as many musicians' hands as possible. Later in 65, George Harrison and John Lennon are dosed by George Harrison's dentist. In 67, Mick Jagger gets his first hit of that acid from an undercover FBI agent, according to London's Daily Mail. And this guy's also an agent with London's MI5, which is, British version of FBI. And so this is some of the way it was happening. And so then in the mid-1960s, you had two of the top figures that were pushing LSD. It was Timothy Leary on the East Coast and Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters on the West Coast with their acid tests. You might have heard of them. They had the Trips Festival on the West Coast around the San Francisco area. And so they had these acid tests where the Grateful Dead first played these parties. And, as part of these acid tests, which were supposedly small homegrown parties, you had the top psychologist in MKUltra there undercover. You had two of his scientists with him. And he said this under legal deposition. John Gittinger, the top psychologist for MKUltra, said, "Me and two other CIA scientists traveled from Washington to San Francisco to be part of these parties undercover." And he said two other MKUltra agents were there too, but they just didn't dress undercover. And so they were kind of like laughed out of the party. But these, and at these parties, it shows that there was also a number of ex-Army guys, ex-Marines, and it all came to show that the best evidence supports that these were MKUltra parties. They're the ones that pushed these parties and sponsored them to push acid like crazy, to undercut the civil rights movement and to undercut the anti-war movement, okay, that was blossoming in that area, because that was a big hub for activists around Berkeley and the San Francisco area. All right, so Courtney Love is born in San Francisco. Her mother was part of these acid tests. They went and hung out at these acid tests. Her father, Hank Harrison, was the first manager for the Grateful Dead, which was the house band for these acid tests.
And then God, right? Yes, he. You know, it's so funny. I live next to the Hollywood Bowl, and tonight is Dead Night, and I just want to get a megaphone and yell at these people, like, "Dude, today we're CIA. You're being duped by spooks. Spooks love jam bands, but so he was very much into like the occult, her father, right?
Yeah. Now he says he's blowing the whistle, and I actually believe they did blow the whistle on a few things. I think he did tell the truth on a few things, and one of the things he was they never got married. Linda Carroll was Courtney Love's mother. Now, she was adopted by a super wealthy family named the Reese's. The Reese's owned gold mines. They had the largest share of Bausch & Lomb, you know, the contact and eyewear group. They were extremely wealthy. They adopt this Linda Carroll. They proceed, according to her own memoir, they were sexually abusing her. The father was an alcoholic and was sexually abusing her throughout her childhood. So her head was all kinds of messed up. And here she is, part of these acid test parties. She's got this young girl, Courtney Love, who's an infant. And by the age of, in different biographies, they say at 2 years old or 3 years old, she starts sending her to therapy, to counseling. Now, I'm a therapist for a living, and I've never seen a 2 or 3 year old. That doesn't happen. You don't get 2 or 3 year olds. It's ridiculous. She's sending them to therapy. And so she says in her memoir that she thinks that Courtney Love might have been abused in one of her childcare facilities.
Now,
all I know is Hank Harrison says in his book about Courtney Love's upbringing that she was throwing tantrums when she had to go back to her mother each time when he had her they had partial custody of her. They each had partial custody. And so her parents convince her to sue for full custody and take Hank Harrison's custody away completely by the age of when she's about 5 or 6 years old. He's got so much money. The Reese's had so much money. They paid Hank Harrison's lawyer to throw the case. And
My God, really?
By the age of 5 or 6, he lost complete custody of her, and he didn't see her again for years and went into a deep depression, he said. Now, meanwhile, so she's hanging out still at all these acid test parties with the mother and is all in all these places. But the mother proceeds to do some strange things. She then travels up with the pranksters. The Merry Pranksters were part of Ken Kesey's group that were throwing the acid test. They were highly infiltrated with a lot of military. They end up following Ken Kesey. Now, Ken Kesey was duped, I believe. He was first a experimenter in the MKUltra experiments, and they were CIA sponsored. And then his head was so messed up by the acid, he was just manipulated along the way. So he ends up going up to the Eugene, Oregon area. The pranksters follow him up there. Linda Carroll follows them up there. And then she goes to New Zealand. And she basically is tired of dealing with Courtney Love. So she kind of gives her up. Courtney Love ends up in a juvenile delinquent facility.
Oh, my God.
By the age of 13 or 14, she sends a letter to Hank Harrison, says, "Can you get me out of here? My doctors have been having sex with me regularly since I was a little kid, and they've been giving me psychohypnotic drugs, Tuenols, all these exotic psychohypnotic drugs," she names in her letter. And these drugs were MKUltra drugs used for hypnosis. Now, the other thing about her time when she's going to therapy and getting all these psychohypnotic drugs and saying her counselors are having sex with her, two women in that same area, a woman named Krista Nicola and Claudia Mullen, went with their therapist, Valerie Wolf, to testify in the 1990s when President Clinton's Secretary of Health held hearings about the CIA experiments in the 1960s.
God.
And they both testified that we were regularly raped and given acid and other drugs and tortured to become CIA assassins. And they both testified this, and this woman, the therapist, testified in this federal hearing that 40 other therapists called her up and said, "Can you tell them that we have patients that are experiencing the same things that your patients are talking about? They were tortured, got drugs. The CIA, they think the CIA did this to them. They could name the names, and they did. They named John Gittinger. They named a number of the people involved with the CIA cultural experiments. They were turned into, zombie, basically with dissociative, what they call multiple personality and or dissociative identity disorder patients." Okay, that's split personality, basically, And so when you torture, as a counselor, I'm a expertise, my expertise is trauma, that when you torture and sexually abuse and give drugs to a child from the ages of 3 to 8 years old, you can split their minds and cause dissociative identity disorder. And lead them to do things they wouldn't know the other personality is doing, you know? And so that's, these women testified to that. They said, one of them said, I was working as a prostitute assassin for the CIA before I went to therapy and got away from it all. And the other one broke away before she was fully done her training. But it was, yeah, it's incredible stories that they told in the federal hearings. But here you got Courtney Love at 14. She comes out. Hank Harrison gets her out of this juvenile delinquent facility and finds that she was drug addicted and she was prostituting herself within the following year. By 15, the mainstream biographies on Courtney Love, one of them was by award-winning author named Melissa Rossi. She says that Courtney Love was basically prostituting for the Asian mafia, for the Japanese mafia. She got letters of Courtney to her boyfriend admitting she was prostituting, you know, talking about it. She started out for the Japanese mafia at 15, and then within 2 or 3 years, she was working for the Taiwanese mafia as a stripper and likely prostitute. And
is this all over the world or within the United States?
No, this is in Taiwan and in Japan. This isn't the United States. She was prostituting in the United States first, and then she went overseas to prostitute. And then she even told her first husband, James Moreland, that she was sleeping with army generals in Alaska. She was prostituting up there. And they told her that all these wars are good for us. And so he says, I didn't realize. I thought I married a punk feminist. It turns out I married a right-wing Phyllis Diller. And so James Moreland said he was scared for his life married to her. When he wouldn't do something she wanted, she would have like, you know, mafia thugs come beat him up to do everything she wanted him to do.
Really?
He said it was unbelievable. He was scared to death until he divorced her and got away from her. So meanwhile, when she's just turned 17 years old, she goes out to visit her husband. You know, Hank Harrison had to kick her out of his house because she was leaving heroin needles all over the place. He couldn't take it, and prostituting, doing all these crazy things.
Oh,
he broke a monster out of a juvenile delinquent facility he found, and he was really sad about it, but there's nothing he could do. So he goes to Dublin to research a book. She's just turned 17, and she visits him out there. And she brings 1,000 hits of LSD, okay? And so she's in Dublin and with him, and he decides to put her up for a bit. Meanwhile, a guy convinced Hank Harrison that he was a deadhead and he loved his work, you know, because he wrote a book about the Grateful Dead after he managed him for 6 months. And so Hank Harrison didn't really know that much about him, but he allowed him to hang out with him. This guy, whose name is O'Leary, Stephen O'Leary, ends up having sex with Courtney at 17. He's an adult guy, has sex with Courtney, and then brings her to London. And when Courtney's in London, she's got her 1,000 hits of acid, and she passes around like candy to all the musicians of Liverpool. Liverpool was the up-and-coming new music place, and so she proceeds to sleep with all these different musicians, saying she lost her virginity to the drummer of the Pogues, to Adam Ant, to a flock of, you know, someone from these other Flock of Seagulls and all these different bands.
You know you're mentally broken when you're fucking somebody in a Flock of Seagulls.
Yeah, she's just all over the place, you know, there in Liverpool. She's giving acid out like candy. Now, that's exactly what Lashbrook did. You know, Robert Lashbrook, the assistant director of MKUltra, did in the 1960s, as you remember. And so she's copying those same behaviors with a CIA agent guiding her along the way. Now, so Harrison said there was another O'Leary with Stephen O'Leary, his older brother, who he believes was named Kevin O'Leary. Now, I verified the Stephen and Kevin O'Leary brothers in a obituary, because Hank Harrison said that Stephen O'Leary admitted on his deathbed in around 2005, 2006, 2007, whatever, that he was on his deathbed, he admitted he had been working for the CIA that whole time. You know, that he was in Dublin with his brother who was bossing him around and was obviously part of the CIA also, Hank Harrison said. Now, Kevin O'Leary, I don't know if it's the same Kevin O'Leary in Shark Tank. I really can't say, but there's lots of pictures of Kevin O'Leary and Courtney Love these days. And they are quite saying, why are Kevin O'Leary and Courtney Love hanging out? Who knows? But I know
– is this recent or way back in the day?
It's in the last 5 or 10 years.
That's pretty
in the last 5 or 10 years, there's pictures of Courtney Love and Hank and Kevin O'Leary hanging out. There they are. Yeah. So I don't know if it's the same Kevin O'Leary, don't get me wrong, but all I can say is I did verify in an obituary that Kevin O'Leary was you know, the brother of Stephen O'Leary, who died in the place in the Minnesota area. And I have that in my film. You can see the obituary in my film that verified what Hank Harrison said about him. And so now Hank Harrison was a little off, you know, he's a little strange about certain things. He says that he thought that his daughter was dissociative when he, you know, hung out with her as a teenager, when she was a teenager, and when he met her again, when he saw her again in 1993, before, you know, Kurt Cobain died. And he says that Kristen Pfaff, another member of Courtney Love's band, thought she was dissociative. Now, from everything I read about Courtney Love, there's a lot of evidence that she probably was dissociative, you know, meaning suffered from dissociative identity disorder, which is the other name for split personality disorder. So, you know, I can't be sure about that. All I can say is that Courtney Love then proceeds to, after she's in London and, you know, in Liverpool and passing out drugs like candy, she then goes to Portland and goes to the music scene there, does the same thing. And she has sex and befriend, you know, becomes the girlfriend of the top punk musician in Portland. And he said she was practically trying to shape him the whole time. And he just had to get away from her eventually. She's
trying to what? Shape him?
Shape him, like mold him, like to do whatever she wanted him to do at all times. Okay. She then ends up in London again and ends up somehow in getting into Joe Strummer's house, convinces him to let her live there for a bit. Joe Strummer, you know, the top punk musician, of the Clash. Okay, she comes back. She's in Los Angeles, and she gets the top punk musician there, a guy named James Morland, to marry her. And then I told you what he said about, you know, being married to her, and he ran for his life from her. Eventually, they were married just 1 year before he was scared to death and got away from her and divorced her.
Her vagina is like got more musicians in it than the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Holy shit!
Right.
She's like hitting Casey Kasem's top one.
So if her vagina, if she was like, you know, like a normal woman, was nice about it all, you know, I don't care who she slept with.
Yeah, me too.
She's a freak and a half in terms of she's right wing. She's, you know, passing out drugs like crazy, trying to get everyone to do drugs. In Los Angeles, she then sleeps with a guy named Eric Erlandson, who becomes her guitarist for Hole. Okay, so Erlandson somehow ends up getting control. He gets the job of managing Michael Jackson's hits or something. He gets these crazy jobs that only a super wealthy guy can kind of get. You know, he's a very bizarre guy. Anyway, so they're in a band together, and she ends up, like, you know, just having sex with him and splitting up with him. And so then she's dating Billy Corgan. She's at a party with Billy Corgan, and Kurt Cobain's album, you know, the Nirvana's album, Nevermind, was rising like crazy on the charts at that time. Now, I talk about in Drugs as Weapons Against Us how when we lost the Vietnam War, we lost the war for the poppy fields. Now, I have, you know, CIA whistleblowers talking about that the CIA was trafficking heroin from the Vietnam area into the United States. I've got even a Frontline episode with Judy Woodruff. I have this in my film of her saying that, you know, interviewing all these people that were involved with the drug trade in Vietnam. But I had to cut some of that out for the length. But she shows a CIA document admitting that they were trafficking heroin from Vietnam to the United States in the 1960s as part of the Vietnam War. So that was a war for the poppy fields. We know that.
Everyone, I mean, they were putting heroin into caskets, right? I mean, like, that to me...
Exactly.
It just blows my mind that this is not a well-known fact that the CIA, when I hear the, you know, MSNBC or CNN talking about, oh, he picked this foreign leader over our intelligence community. I'm like, well, the foreign leader didn't pack caskets of dead soldiers with heroin, didn't like green light 19 hijackers to come into the United States, didn't lie about weapons of mass destruction over and over and over again. I mean, like, this whitewashing of what this group has done is like so disgusting.
I know. And so I remember I was on a Coast to Coast AM, you know, interview, and a guy, a GI, called in and said, yeah, I witnessed them putting the heroin in the caskets. I was over there in Vietnam, and I witnessed it happening. So, yeah, it's just confirmed by so many sources that this happened. Anyway, so after we lost Vietnam, CIA went into the Afghanistan area starting in 1979. Okay, and they had – so I have in my film CBS and NPR CBS radio and the NPR experts went to Afghanistan. Two guys, a man and woman actually, who were also writers for the Boston Globe, who say that – it was an NPR expert. I'm sorry. It was a PBS expert. But either way, these two reporters say that Gulbuddin Hekmatyar was one of the key point guys, and his group was called the Muslim Brotherhood, but they weren't Muslim. They were heroin trafficking. They had heroin laboratories, and they were heroin trafficking. They were just pretending to be Muslims, you know. But anyway, they were over there from 79 onwards into the 80s and into the early 90s, manufacturing and trafficking heroin in the second biggest place for poppy fields. They call it the Golden Crescent for poppy fields around Afghanistan, you know. So the Vietnam area is the Golden Triangle for poppy fields, and the Afghanistan area is called the Golden Crescent for poppy fields.
I mean, if you look at Uma Abedin, which is Hillary Clinton's right-hand woman, she has a lot of connections to the Muslim Brotherhood. Her family is like just very high ups there, and they're always trying to label as a terrorist group, which I think is just a label to divert from what's really going on. And it sounds like they're basically the face of heroin distribution or opium distribution. I mean, the guy that we put in charge of Afghanistan, who used to work at, some big oil company out of the United States, his brother was one of the biggest opium dealers in the world. He was actually in charge of that whole thing.
Yeah, no doubt. And so I have a CIA whistleblower, John Stockwell, saying in the late 80s in an interview that he knew the CIA planes were over there in Afghanistan getting that heroin out of there in that area. And so come around early 1990s, they had so much supply coming to the United States, coming into Europe, and they needed to get the demand to match the supply. And their old tried and true method was getting musicians to promote it inadvertently. They didn't even know they were what they were doing, but inadvertently to promote it. And I argue that a psychological profile was done on different musicians of who would promote it best. And Kurt Cobain had a massive stomach problem and had tried it a handful of times, according to his diary, about four or five times in his life over 4 years just to stop his chronic stomach problem. So he was a good guy, guy to target. And that's what they had. So here's Courtney Love hanging out with Billy Corgan, dating Billy Corgan at a party. And there's Kurt Cobain. She leaves her date, Billy Corgan, goes right to Kurt Cobain, and starts, dating him right then and after that, and immediately gets knocked up with his baby. He does the right thing and marries her with a prenuptial agreement because he didn't trust her completely, but he married her. All the people around Seattle say that he never used heroin regularly. It was only when he met her that she got him using daily. And that she was this kind of tornado that came into Seattle. Things were really peaceful in Seattle. There was some heroin, but it was peaceful. People got along. She just caused chaos in Seattle, and people started dying very quickly around her. She was using with a number of different people that would overdose when she used with them. Now she got Kurt
John.
Cobain.
Real quick, do you think that she's doing all this on orders? Like, hey, infiltrate this, or is she have a handler? I've read some stuff as I prepared for this that some people thought that Courtney Love's dad, and you seem to think that he had less of a role in this, which I have no reason not to believe you, is that some people thought that he was Kurt Cobain's handler. Like, we hear that a lot, that these assets they have where they break these guys down, these MK Ultras, they break them down into, men are assassins, they're highly trained killing machines, and then women they call the sex kittens, which is like you see a lot of them walking around in leopard skin stuff. Usually I thought that meant chicks like the Bang Black guys, but apparently that's deeper MK Ultra stuff. But that is that when you see them in leopard skin, that they have handlers. What are your thoughts on any of that? Is she doing this on orders or this instincts?
Well, first thing I'll say is that U.S. Senate Church Committee's report on MK Ultra in there they said that one of the U.S. intelligence's tactics was to use women, sex, and drugs to manipulate musicians, political musicians in particular, to do, you know, get them what they want out of them or destroy or neutralize them. Okay. And so that, you know, Courtney Love just fits that, you know, of course. Now, I think Courtney Love actually was being manipulated by handlers, but I think that Kurt Cobain wasn't. And that's why when he tried to break away from her, he was divorcing her. Now, their lawyer, Rosemary Carroll, said that he said to her, you know, please take Courtney Love out of my will and we're getting a divorce. Then Courtney Love went to her and said, please, you know, get me the most vicious divorce lawyer possible. And Tom Grant, a private detective that Courtney Love actually hired right before Kurt Cobain's death as a front, he ends up finding out that she had a lot to do with his death. And so he actually started investigating her. But he taped all of his interview, all of the people he talked with. So he taped Rosemary Carroll saying that she thinks that Courtney Love was involved in Kurt Cobain's death. She found a bunch of handwriting that she had, practice handwriting, where she was practicing his, you know, Kurt Cobain's handwriting, it appeared.
Oh my God, really?
Yes, and the suicide note had two different handwritings, according to everyone who saw it. You know, one in the body of it, and then which just sounded like a breakup of Nirvana, you know, message, which he was breaking up Nirvana. You know, Dave Grohl, you know, confirmed that in an interview, and Chris Novoselic actually, you know, also confirmed that. I mean, you know, they confirmed he was breaking up Nirvana. He was actually going to form a new band with Kristen Pfaff, who was the bass player of Hole, who he had a crush on, and Kristen Pfaff loved Kurt Cobain too, and so they were going to form a new band together. And I'm not sure who else was going to be in that band, but Kristen Pfaff was murdered soon after.
Whoa! Okay. Yeah, you're right. I totally remember that.
And the person that was last seen with Kristen Pfaff was Eric Erlandson, who was Courtney Love's, you know, guitar player in Hole. And he was, you know, someone she met in Los Angeles and had sex with in Los Angeles. And he seems to be, you know, in on all of this also.
Oh, so, you think that the guy from you think there's possibilities, allegedly, that he was some kind of like he had something to do with both of these or any of these tragedies?
I do. I think, well, it's obviously something to do with Kristen Pfaff's death. Kristen Pfaff, by all accounts, had gotten clean and sober. She went into rehab. When she heard about Cobain's death, she immediately went into rehab. She was so distraught, and she got clean and sober, and all accounts had her as clean and sober at that point. And she was moving all of her stuff out of her Seattle apartment in a way from back to Minneapolis, you know, where she was from originally, where she had a band called Janitor Joe. She had gotten back together with Janitor Joe. She, you know, she was going to, you know, do some stints with them before she joined Kurt Cobain. So anyway, so she's getting all her stuff. She's got all her stuff in the truck, and her friend, her male friend, is sleeping in the truck to guard it because they were in an area of Seattle was huge. Had a huge amount of heroin addicts and, you know, easily could have gotten ripped off. So he slept in the truck. She's in her place. And she saw Eric Erlandson go and go into her apartment. And he didn't know what to think of it, but he just thought, okay, well, he's just visiting her. And then he finds her the next morning, you know, dead.
God.
So Kristen Pfaff's mother pressed real hard to investigate it as a murder, and police wouldn't investigate it as a murder. The brother, you know, pressed to investigate as a murder. They wouldn't investigate as a murder. But with Cobain, you know, what she did is so Cobain, a year before his death, he found a cure to a stomach problem. And he said basically he was getting clean and sober. Now, we know he was clean and sober at least a month before his death because when he had that coma in Rome, I don't know if you remember, he had a coma in Rome. What happened there was he was already getting away from her. And he just wanted to see his daughter, so he wanted her to come over and bring over, you know, their daughter, and, you know, Frances. So Love brings over the daughter to Rome, and he proceeds to go into a coma. It turns out when the doctors analyzed his blood and his system in Rome, that he had no illegal substances in his system at all, except just a little bit of you know, champagne and this Rohypnol, which is roofies. Okay,
yes. So
she roofied him, and she had the prescription for roofies, where that came from. Okay, she got it in England as a prescription for sleeping, and because it's illegal in England, but it's illegal here, of course. So she gets that in England, she puts it in his drink, obviously, and roofies him, and almost causes him to die. I mean, it was her first attempt to kill him, I believe, because he went into a coma for about 24 hours. I mean, he nearly died. And so he comes out and doesn't remember anything that happened, because you know what roofies do, they erase your memory. And he's just pissed off, and he doesn't know what to do, but he was getting away from her. And
you think he knew it was her that roofied him?
I don't know positively. I don't know for sure, because you know his memory was erased. But you know, I heard some things. I just don't know for sure. But I know he was trying to get away. He was already divorcing her, getting away from her. And so at the time, you know, so basically she, you know, at the time, around the time of his death, she calls in a fake police, you know, thing saying that she's Kurt Cobain's mother and she can't find him. When she knew exactly where he was calling her regularly because he wanted to be in touch with Frances, his daughter, even though he was trying to get away from her. He was, you know, she did a number of things. Then she pretended to overdose at the time of his death to try to, you know, get it. And she got herself locked up so she couldn't be, you know, blamed for anything that happened. Meanwhile, she's paying this male nanny, Michael Cally DeWitt, to watch, you know, to watch the house. And that was the nanny for Frances, you know, Cobain, their daughter. And he's a heroin addict, and she's giving him the heroin regularly. She's given Eric Erlandson, you know, heroin regularly. She paid a male bodyguard for Kurt Cobain, who he kept firing, and she kept rehiring, who was also a heroin addict, who was always there. So there was a group of people there to do the deed in the end. Now, who really did the deed? That's, you know, who actually shot, you know, Kurt Cobain is another story. Now, a guy named Eldon Hoke, who they call El Duce, who was a musician by the stage name El Duce, he said he passed two polygraph exams with the top polygrapher and said that Courtney Love offered me $50,000 to kill Kurt Cobain, to blow his head off. And
oh my God.
And so she ends up looking for him, you know, to follow through on it, but he was actually on tour. So he says in one film for the film, you know, in the movie Kurt and Courtney, Nick Broomfield's film about them, that so I didn't get to accept that money, but I know who did. And he starts to say Alan, and then he holds himself up. But then in another interview on tape, he says Alan Wrench. And Alan Wrench was the last person to be seen with Eldon Hoke when he died several days after being filmed saying his name. You know,
oh, he died after that, this guy?
Died a few days later, yeah.
Oh, wow. My God.
Last person seen with him was you know, this Alan Wrench. So now you end up also finding the fact that Kurt Cobain had three times the amount of heroin that would have killed a severe addict instantly in his system. And you got the top, you know, forensic pathologist in the country saying one film, this guy's named Cyril Wecht. He's famous from the Concussion movie about the, you know, that Will Smith played. You remember the film, the movie Concussion about the NFL concussions? Well, he was the boss of the Will Smith character in that movie, Cyril Wecht. You know, in real life, he was the boss. And so Cyril Wecht is about 80 years old. And he says on film that I've never seen anybody proceed to shoot up heroin and then shoot themselves. It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense at all.
He says in another news broadcast that he believes that Kurt Cobain was murdered and was made to look like a suicide. He said, from all the facts, that's what I believe.
I've struggled with drugs. I think a lot of people have. And one of the blessings is I was never into heroin. I'm a go fast guy, not a go slow guy. But what I've heard about heroin addicts is what they say is that it's like going back to the womb. And it's like this warm, fuzzy feeling that I think that if just using logic,
Yeah.
Why would you blow your head off if you're back in the womb? If you're having this feeling of this warmth over you, and I'm not condoning, dude, please don't do heroin. I think it's the worst drug out there. Just please don't do it. But it's like, it doesn't make sense that you would want to further, you want to blow your head off. That seems like because you want to end some kind of mental pain when you're supposedly in this warm, like womb type feel.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And so it doesn't make any sense at all. So meanwhile, this guy, Eldon Hoke, talked to the Seattle police. He talked to the Los Angeles police. He said, hey, this is what happened. And none of the police departments would investigate the prime suspect, Courtney Love. You know, and so Tom Grant's bringing this evidence of on tape, their lawyer saying that they were getting divorced. You know, the lawyer is saying that Kurt Cobain, that Kurt Cobain said, take her out of my will. You know, he brings over evidence that somebody used Kurt Cobain's credit card after his death. You know, they took it out of his wallet and used it after his death. And he's got the transactions that they used it after his death. They got, you know, the police say they had no fingerprints on the shotgun, which they say is ridiculous. You know, Cobain's also got Valium in the system, which showed that somebody dosed his drink with Valium to get him super groggy. And then they obviously held him down and started shooting him up with heroin. And before they shot him with the shotgun.
Find out, John, that they won't investigate this, does that at all make you think that there's I know we're talking murder, which is the darkest of dark, but that there might be a more darker force at work here? Like, is this a lot of things that we see when we see these huge stars blow up, and that, you know, there's this whole MK Ultra thing behind it, whether it's them, their handlers or whatever, pushing a particular narrative, which, you know, the grunge scene was very much, you know, I mean, we went from hair metal and metal, which was cocaine and craziness, to heroin, which is
laid back,
which is grunge, which was heroin. Him wanting to get sober off it.
Yeah.
Is there a darker hand at work that makes you think that the Seattle wasn't going to, the Seattle police weren't going to investigate it because they were basically told not to?
Right. No doubt. I mean, Tom Grant was a former police officer. So he had all the evidence laid out. He had a lot of it on tape. He had, you know, so many documents showing, you know, a lot of what was going on. He brought it all to the Los Angeles Police Department where he used to work. He brought it to the Seattle Police, and they ignored him. So obviously there was a much larger hand at work. And there's the fact that Courtney Love proceeds to, attack other people after that. She, you know, Courtney Love's bass player, obviously Kristen Pfaff, she dies mysteriously after that. Courtney Love then punches Kathleen Hanna in the face, the lead singer for Bikini Kill, and gets away with it without, you know, any kind of prosecution. She punches loads of people in the face. She attacks tons of people. They try to bring suits, you know, criminal charges against her. The worst she gets is a misdemeanor. Okay, she's a monster out of control. And she's also promoting heroin and, you know, other drugs, cocaine and acid like crazy. In her first interview with Barbara Walters, she said that her father gave her acid when she was a child because he wanted to make her into a genius. And that's what acid can do. Okay, this is for viewers, 25 million viewers were watching her interview with Barbara Walters when she says this crazy stuff. In her book she came out with, she says that crack made her math whiz. And crack cocaine can make girls math whizzes. And that's what she says in her book. She's pushing cocaine. She's just, you know, crazy stuff. Yeah. It's all in line with MKUltra pushing drugs, you know, like crazy on young, you know, feminists, young punk, you know, women that are like idolizes Courtney Love, who's actually, you know, ridiculous, who's actually some kind of, you know, operative, it appears. And I don't know. I think she didn't even know everything she was doing. I think she's being handled and, you know, but that's just what, you know, my best evidence says. Now, my wife was knocking on the door for us to go to a show. I'm sorry to say.
Okay. Florence and the Machine. It's fine. But, you're going to see Florence and the Machine?
Yeah, we are.
All right. All right. Well, you know what?
Let me ask one question.
You said that
they pushed heroin, then they pushed an LSD. Do you think they're pushing Xannies and promethazine now? on all the new rappers that are dying? All the ones that want to quit all of a sudden go to. Is it the same thing?
Xanax and what else?
Promethazine, the lean, that purple stuff.
I heard about that stuff. I'm sorry I don't know a lot about that stuff. But I'll say, though, that it's obvious that they were pushing ecstasy because the top ecstasy dealer in New York, a guy named Michael Caruso, Village Voice came out with a front page article how Michael Caruso was working for the FBI and, you know, was a former mafia ecstasy kingpin when he went undercover and became the personal assistant for two members of Wu-Tang Clan. And he got them to promote ecstasy, to come to ecstasy parties and all that stuff. And they didn't realize. And when that Village Voice article came out, they fired him immediately. But no one talked about them firing him immediately. They only talked about how he's part of, you know, he's their personal assistant. Okay, so they basically manipulated Wu-Tang Clan to promote ecstasy without, you know, them being aware of what the hell was going on. And that was, you know, he was working, being paid by the FBI at that time. So it's obvious that, yeah, they manipulate rappers and other musicians to promote all these
the time, dude. They wrap up. Final question, then we're all going to go see Florence and the Machine. Sure. Listen, should we have sympathy for Courtney Love? Is there a part of us that is, I mean, like, it's very hard to say that about somebody who's been basically associated, allegedly, with two murders, okay? But is there a part of us that should be kind of sympathetic to that? She was thrown into a world, and you have more of you seem to think her dad had less to say. I more and more think about it, especially when she says her dad gave her acid. I'm thinking more. He's involved with the Grateful Dead. I think there might be more involvement with that. But should we have a moment? Should we have more sympathy for her and the fact she's thrown into a world of shit with no parents that really were there to guard her when she was at her most vulnerable?
Well, let me just say about Hank Harrison. Hank Harrison came out with this book, Love Kills, about her killing Cobain. And he came out in his book about the fact that this guy, Stephen O'Leary, admitted working for the CIA and started bringing her around to these different places. So he came out with some important information. If he was part of things, he sure blew the whistle on a lot of things. So I don't really know about him. But her, it's up to each individual whether they want to be sympathetic or not. And here's my wife getting me for the show.
Okay, we're going. We're wrapping it up. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. All right.
But I'll just, you know, that, you know, it's up to each individual about sympathy. I don't know. I try to stay neutral and just say, put the facts out there. If you want to be sympathetic to her, you can. If you want to hate her, you should too. You can be sympathetic to her and hate her at the same time. Hate the part of her that, you know, contributed to the murder of Kurt Cobain and Kristen Pfaff. And then be sympathetic to the part of her that had the childhood she had. Sure.
Well, John, thank you very much. John's wife, thank you very much for being understanding. And we appreciate you, John. I can't wait till we find another topic to have you on. And we look forward to having you back. Enjoy the concert. You deserved it. And we appreciate you very much.
Thanks.
Guys, thank you, John. XG, you're a wonderful person. We will see you all soon. Take care. And we're getting closer to the big 200. Take care, everybody.